I'm Christopher Light, and this is The Connection. The story of the brothers, Stephen and James Haywood, is one of inspirational family loyalty. It's also a medical story of our time about the burdens of scientific research. In the winter of 1998, Stephen Haywood was diagnosed with the incurable ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. When his older brother, James Haywood, heard about Stephen's bad news, he left his job as an engineer in San Diego and moved with his wife back home to Newton, Massachusetts. Ever since then, he has been obsessively trying to find a cure for the disease that, within a matter of 4 or 5 years, would kill his brother. In effect, James Haywood took on himself to do what the NIH, the FDA, and Stephen's own doctors wouldn't do, which was spend night and day on an impossible dream. With more than $1 million raised and the attention of experimental gene therapy researchers now, with a host of critics, too, they're trying everything they can. We're talking this hour about one family's fight with the medical-industrial complex. Connection listeners, is every man supposed to become his own NIH? What do you learn when you decide to fight a terminal illness? Should the medical profession be encouraging this sort of guerrilla science, which may be, in fact, one step away from fantasy? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255, or 1-800-423-TALK, to make the connection with Stephen and James Haywood in our studio. Stephen Haywood, I wish you'd just take us back to the moment in December 98 when you got the diagnosis and you and the family decided, in effect, hell no, we won't go.
Sure. Actually, I'll take you back a little further even. I started having problems with my right hand when I was working. I was building a house in California, and I assumed it was fatigue or overwork and sort of ignored it because we were trying desperately to finish. After sort of going through a bunch of great neurologists at Stanford, we had a rough diagnosis of a benign form of ALS, which we hoped for and would have been not the end of the world. I moved back to Boston and went to MGH for further testing, and that was in December 98, where unfortunately I did find damage in my other limbs. At that point, I'd done enough research to know pretty clearly what that meant. There weren't many diseases that would look like that. At that point, I called Jamie right after the testing, which took about 5 hours, about 4 hours longer than it should have, and told him it doesn't look good. He was in California at the time working at the Neuroscience Institute and sort of took it upon himself to start researching as much as possible. I think I started figuring out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, and my reaction was not Jamie's, which was just to try and make my life as happy as I could. Jamie was slightly more active.
Should we let Jamie speak for himself?
Sure.
Well, it's funny, actually. The first thing Stephen said after, you know, the news does not look good was, I guess I better go buy that Harley I've been thinking about. yeah, it's funny. It wasn't like there was this immediate switch to say, okay, we're going to make a difference here. When I originally left and I talked with my boss 2 days later, the thought was we were actually literally just going to go on vacation and enjoy life as much as we could for the next year or so, or at least until we ran out of money. And in the next sort of 2.5 months when I was finishing up work, I didn't really do much work for the Institute. I actually just basically researched ALS. And what was clear was that this whole field had had all these amazing breakthroughs, and yet the critical step that it was necessary to make these things become treatments wasn't really happening. The research was still in this mode of, well, why is this happening? You know, sort of that's the scientific question. Why is this happening? What's causing this? And the question when you try and make a difference in a disease is, well, what can I do about this? It's not, and I think that if you put a time frame on that, that's what immediately made the difference. And what convinced us to get started as a family, start the foundation, and to try and really actively do development work was this realization that we knew this particular finding, that there was a problem with the disease, and we had a way to make a difference in it. And when we looked around for who could do that, the answer came back, well, you should. And
you really found that you were asking a different sort of question.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting thing. A lot of people actually go through this now, and the internet invites, I suppose, all of us to do it. Parents of hemophiliac babies, for example, or autistic children, or whatever, they suddenly, you know, at age 32, with a literature degree or something, start becoming medical students in a hurry and obsessively overnight. I wonder, I don't know anybody really who's done it. What's it like to sort of be a self-starting, okay, I'm going to med school on my own?
One of the things that I'm, you know, amazingly aware of is that nothing that we're doing would have been possible without the internet. And I talked with a patient who's had ALS about 12 years, and he told me about his story about going to the library and researching the articles and going through this. And I remember in the first 2 months, I literally read 2,000 abstracts, which is just not possible in a library. There's no way you could do that. And it was all possible through the internet. And partly because of the amazing place I was, I had the advantage of being surrounded by the best neuroscientists in the world. The Neuroscience Institute is an amazing place. And my friends there were helping me to understand what it was that I was reading. So it was both finding the relevant information and then having the expertise to put it in context.
Can I just say, I want to resist the lure a little bit here myself, and I also want to wonder, raise the question whether the internet is sort of a trap and promises more than it can deliver. Also, I wonder, I mean, maybe the medical questions, maybe the questions that the great medical schools ask are the right ones in the end, and maybe the perspective of a panicked family member or patient isn't the right one.
I think that,
Stephen.
My experience when I first started looking at information about hopefully what I thought was not ALS, there's a huge amount of information out there. And if with a little bit of discernment, you can decide whether or not it's valid or valuable. I can't really think of a situation in which a greater amount of knowledge can be harmful. And the problem with you know, listening to exactly what your doctors say is that although I've had wonderful, wonderful doctors, they just don't have the time or the ability to get all this information that you can get with a little bit of study and awareness.
But can that be true, that they can't get information that you can get on the internet?
No, they have the information. But what we did before my diagnosis, for example, was to find out what we wanted to ask Dr. Brown. And we said, okay, this is a list of five questions. Those questions we could not have come up with unless we'd been researching beforehand. Mm-hmm. So our questions were more to the point and more important than if we just went in there blank.
Yeah, okay. What did the doctors say to you? And did any of them tell you, in effect, to go away and sort of can't be bothered, or
no, I mean,
ready to die?
Yeah, we hear stories sometimes from people who their doctors say, oh, go home and prepare yourself, make a will. I have had nothing but wonderful experiences with my doctors, and they, I mean, just incredible men and women, and the amount of caring and effort they put in is mind-boggling. The problem is that they can't do it all. I mean, they're treating patients, they're doing research, they can't develop drugs at the same time. It's not possible.
There was also
James.
I had an interesting discussion about this specific topic recently with one of my good friends who's a doctor. Doctors are responsible for doing no harm. They're responsible for sort of taking what the FDA has recommended, taking at some level. A doctor's almost incapable, because of the structure of the system, of assuming the risk-reward question that Stephen might ask. Hmm. So in other words, the statement that, you know, as a doctor, I can't do any harm is different for Stephen. Stephen is sort of at some level is experiencing harm every single day that he's going through this illness, and his willingness to take risks in a way that might make a difference for his disease are different. And secondly, when a doctor says to you something, it comes out as an endorsement in a way that as a person, if you go to your doctor with an idea, they're much more willing to consider, because they can't endorse an idea that's sort of not proven. But they're certainly, I think the ALS doctors that we work with, and I think most of the really good ones, are willing to sort of let the patients work on ideas they bring to them. And that shifts the burden.
But then the question for you has become sort of, okay, where do you look for help? Do you go to acupuncture? Do you go to standard medicine? Do you go to oriental medicine? Do you go to prayer? Do you go to something new? In your case, you've honed in on the idea of gene therapy and a genetic explanation for what's going wrong here in Stephen's body, and the hope that the introduction of repair genes through the insertion of a virus could make a big difference. How did you come to that judgment? And again, I think the question is this a kind of decision that patients and their families ought to have to make on their own?
When, I mean, again, it's sort of, remember, I was in the center of neuroscience in San Diego, so I had sort of some really amazing advisors. But let's go to the question. There was a protein that a new research paper had shown was absent in ALS, and that particular protein could be, worded as the primary cause of the neurons dying. It wasn't the cause of the disease, but it was the primary cause of the neurons dying. So you say, this is now absent, what do I do about it? Well, you could start a drug discovery program to find a drug that would increase the expression of this protein, which is a difficult and long process, and that's what the pharmaceutical companies do. Or the other alternative, sort of seemed obvious at the time, was let's just put, I mean, the phrase was literally, let's put the damn protein back in there. And in this case, the protein was, gene therapy was the most straightforward way to accomplish that. And as in all fields in medical science, there's sort of the myth of where it really is and the reality of where it really is. And gene therapy, as we're just seeing now with sort of the new successes with hemophilia and recently in France with an immune disorder, is starting to make a difference. And I knew this because I was dealing with these researchers, so I knew that it was possible to connect these two fields in a way that was positive. And that's when you realize that, I had to go find the gene therapist. It was a straightforward recruiting problem.
But what do you mean to say when you say that the cover story is different from the reality?
You know, there's this wonderful phrase. Every time I went to go see the ALS doctors about the gene therapy in the beginning, so gene therapy doesn't work. Well, that's true. Gene therapy has not worked, and it had not worked at the time, and now there's new data. And I think that what's interesting about science is you end up with these ivory towers of knowledge where someone's specialty is one area, and they're not really aware of the advances being made in another area. And I think that what we did here was to bridge these two fields together, literally by connecting two experts. And what you realize is that actually what we're trying to do is probably possible and realistic and safe.
Meantime, part of the burden of becoming complete activists in your own case, sort of presiding over your own choices, finding your own doctors, pushing the envelope of what's possible, you know, therapeutically, you also have to raise your own money. You've raised well over $1 million now for this effort. How'd you do it? And can everybody imagine taking on that sort of burden?
I think it was surprisingly easy when we first reached out. We basically sent a letter out to family and friends outlining what we were trying to do, and got a huge response immediately. After that started, we sort of built on that. I don't know if it's applicable for every disease. We felt with ALS that we had a good target, and we decided to go for it. We very quickly found, after we got rolling, that we discovered other targets, and we built on that as well. But
I'm sure it helps to have been written up very sympathetically in the New Yorker magazine.
Yes, that's a great article.
But again, the question is, you know, is this a model for everybody? And I put it to Connection listeners. I mean, can we, I said, can every man expect to be his own NIH? Can everybody be expected to search the internet the way people do? I just checked out, you dial up Lou Gehrig's disease on the internet and you find 15,000 internet pages on the subject. Dial up autism, you get more than 100,000 pages. Dial up AIDS, you get 976,000 pages. Breast cancer, 500,000 pages. You guys have raised $1 million. Do we expect that? I also think there's a question here. You know, a number of, Christopher Reeve has become a rallying point for research on spinal injuries. Ara Persigian, the Notre Dame football coach, is a point person for raising money and doing research on something I'd never heard of, Niemann-Pick type C disease. Doug Flutie is doing work for autism. But are we ready to sort of split up the medical burdens here sort of every man and woman for himself?
Well, I don't think that's what's happening at all. In fact, I was just thinking about Christopher Reeve as a perfect example. He's not taking money away from anything that it was going to elsewhere. And think about how much of an impact he's had on spinal cord injuries. So if he had not done that, or if he had not been injured 3 or 4 years ago, people would be set back 1 or 2 years. That's a very straightforward equation. Maybe it's not that perfect in every disease, but I think most diseases, this kind of effort always helps.
1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the case of Stephen and James Haywood under enormous pressure, making an absolutely obsessive run against what the medical world calls an incurable disease, ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. 1-800-423-TALK. Denise is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Denise.
Thanks for taking my call. Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. I'm
calling because my brother has ALS, and I'm calling to thank James and Stephen for the remarkable efforts that they have made, and I know that I speak for the families of many victims when I say that we're incredibly grateful for the fact that they have taken this illness out of the realm of an area where we didn't have access to the information. We didn't have the intellectual wherewithal to go out and try to figure out what to do. And they're translating this information in a way that the researchers, as wonderful and as well-meaning as they are, cannot do. They've also changed the contract, and you talked about this a little bit, for what is known as an orphan disease. Not enough people get it to make it worthwhile for the medical industrial complex to find a drug to cure it. They changed the contract from one of what's the epidemiology, what's the potential for finding a cure someday, to let's keep the people who have this illness alive. Let's keep them alive now. The other point I want to make, Chris, is that there are it's really sad, I think, what's happened to slow down the pace of research on gene therapy with the sad death of the young man in Pennsylvania. There are many iatrogenic, doctor-induced diseases that kill people every day, and it's really, I think, not logical to stop researching treating people with ALS with gene therapy and other terrible diseases as well, when these people, I think, have the right to make the choice, you know, if they're facing a fatal illness, to be able to decide for themselves if they want to subject themselves to experimental treatment.
These are important points, Karen. They're right smack on the subject. What is the state of gene therapy and gene therapy research after the death in Pennsylvania?
You know, one of the things that's clear is that there's this concept of whether something is safe enough to try in human beings. And they think, and it's described as a sort of a binary option. No, it's not proven safe enough. Yes, it is proven safe enough. What's been clear since this death is that this binary switch, the determination of when something is safe enough, has moved substantially. And the risk-reward equation that the NIH and the FDA are willing to tolerate has moved, and I think actually completely inappropriately. And for example, there are many other treatments where substantially risky things are done to patients routinely, particularly in the surgery field, and a lot is done in the cancer field, where very high-risk treatments are given to patients and very desperate in the end point. With ALS and with gene therapy, or with other deadly diseases and gene therapy, the presumption has been now you had better prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that you're not going to hurt anyone again before you treat someone. I would estimate that it's probably cost us between 6 months to a year. And the way I balance that risk-reward equation, I don't know whether the gene therapy we're working on is curing the disease. In fact, I know that it won't.
Is anybody stopping you at this point from going ahead with it?
I think that we have decided to pull back our application until we have more data, just because we know what would happen if we went in with insufficient data.
What do you think would happen?
I think we would be told to go and collect more data, so we're just going to go get the data ahead of time.
What is your hope for gene therapy underlying all this? When do you expect to be ready for it? And what is the process going to be, and what's the hope of an outcome?
I would hope to do this early next year, and I think that's shifted from hoping to originally been able to do it this summer. Maybe I think more realistically we're looking at spring again next year as well, so about a year from now.
And what's the idea of the procedure?
The problem with the procedure is that you have to actually inject in multiple points in the spinal cord, which, even though it sounds horrendous, the early animal data we have suggests that there really isn't any injury from doing that. The hoped effect is that it would be able to fix the primary cause of neuronal death, which would give the body a chance to recover around the injury. And it's not a cure, definitely, and it certainly doesn't deal with the underlying cause of the disease, but it might really be a chance to sort of arrest the progress or slow the progress
down.
It's
also possible that it could allow the body to come back into balance. And we don't know.
And it also could do nothing at all, which is another very realistic option.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Stephen James Haywood ALS connection, a connection with their own search for a cure. 1-800-423-TALK. George is on the line.
Hello. I think every patient has to take responsibility for their own health. Doctors are there to help you, but it is your body and it is your life. It's like the old joke about the ham and egg breakfast. The chicken is interested, but the pig is committed.
Yeah.
You know, and the doctor is the chicken in this case, and you're the pig. I know from my own experience, I have a friend who has MS who's been devising his own regimen to deal with that problem fairly successfully, and he's not educated as a doctor, but he's a very intelligent person, and he does have the community of interest that's on the internet. I have another friend, a cousin, who works with autistic children, and the ability for her to deal with her students increased tenfold, a hundredfold when she got online and was able to communicate with all these other people who are interested in the question of autism. I have another friend who has Crohn's disease, and she's always looking out for information as well. And in my own case, I have asthma, and I don't want to take any medication that I don't have to, so I have to study by myself. And in these days of the HMO, when you've got 15 minutes or a half an hour once a year with a primary care physician, you have to protect yourself. You have to be committed to your own health and your own well-being. And
George, of course you have to take personal charge, and yet there are limits. I mean, it seems to me there are limits. You mentioned autism. We did a program a few months ago with a mother of an autistic child. Her name was Karen Cerussi, and she'd written a book about how the doctors had sort of said, in effect, make him comfortable. And she said, wait a sec, that's not the question in my life. I want him to get better. And she doped out a totally unorthodox diagnosis that he had a basically milk-based dietary allergic reaction here. She stuck with it, and he got completely better. Heroic story, but you also sort of wonder if she didn't sort of hit a very, very remote number, you know, on a bet here. I mean, how many patients can hope to sort of beat the medical profession at that kind of analysis?
Well, just imagine, let me give you an example. Imagine that your friend with MS trying a few different things, finding that some things work for him slowly, even if it's aspirin or who knows, any drug that you can get available, and then sharing that information with thousands of other patients across the country. That's the only way that you can test a number of different therapies, if it's acupuncture, anything, and have some sort of idea of an effect, because there's no way to do that clinically.
James.
I think one of the what I like to do, and I'm a businessman, I come from the world where you think about shareholders and who you work for and whose interest you're representing in all cases. And one of the things that's interesting to me is that think about who actually works for the patient. And I think that doctors do, but at another level, their real careers and opportunities are aligned with the institutions and the areas they work for. And as we mentioned with HMOs, they're no longer rewarded for treating patients in the most aggressive manner. It's just a different system. And I found that when I looked at this system, let's go specifically into ALS. The NIH is responsible for doing good scientists. The researchers work for the process of science, which is discovering, you know, at the detail level, the interactions of all these different things. I don't think there's an individual in our society that works for the patient. There's not someone whose job it is, whose responsibility it is, to find a treatment for Stephen or for Denise's brother or for anyone who has ALS at this point in time. I find that imagine a burning building with 30,000 people in it. If there was a stadium burning down with 30,000 people in it, we would move the sun, the moon, and the earth as a society to make a difference for those. Well, that's the situation I feel we're looking at with ALS. There are 30,000 people dying of something that we will someday cure as a society, and there is not someone whose job it is to figure out immediate interventions that might make a difference for those patients.
Boy, that puts the question very, very clearly, shall we say. After the break, I want to call on Dr. Mason Freeman, who runs the gene therapy program at the Massachusetts General Hospital. I'm not sure you know him. I know he knows your case, though, and I want to press this question: whether institutionally, through no particular fault or heroism on the part of any individual, patients, in fact, do have a more productive angle on the resolution of their crises than the best doctors do. It's a provocative idea. Stephen and James Haywood are our guests. Stephen was diagnosed a year and a half ago with Lou Gehrig's disease. In the normal course, he would be said to have 4, 5, 6 years, perhaps, of life ahead of him. He and his brother James have decided they're going to try every door for a solution and a cure. In the meantime, give them a call at 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about ALS. And two brothers, kind of life and death, stand against what medical science says is an incurable disease. Stephen and James Haywood haven't accepted that. The phone is 1-800-423-8255. James Haywood just said, in effect, that patients have a better, more productive angle on the question than the best doctors do. Mason Freeman is on the line. He's a doctor at the Massachusetts General Hospital in charge of the gene therapy program there. I just wonder, Dr. Freeman, make what you can of that argument. The doctors cannot assume the risk-reward posture that the patient is in and has to contend with.
Well, good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
I certainly think there is some truth to that assertion, because doctors often have a fairly large set of responsibilities, and the focus that James and Stephen have been able to apply to this problem is certainly difficult for a physician to generate with the many demands on their time. But I think there's an important distinction that needs to be made about kinds of doctors. Most of the doctors that we see in our society are devoted entirely to clinical medicine and the care of patients in their offices full time. The academic physicians, many of which I believe James and Stephen have had the opportunity to see, divide their lives between being able to see patients day-to-day to handle their immediate medical needs and also spending time trying to solve the problems that we don't
have. But he said it's not
for
a matter of good doctors and bad. It's a matter of life is a matter of perspective, and what you can do depends on sort of where you're standing. He says just they're in a better position than you are.
Well, I think they certainly can spend more time in many ways to search out these issues, but I think that what's very important about this is being able to find the research questions that are amenable to therapy and then to apply the intelligence that we have in the medical community. And there are people they've seen who are working very hard on attempting to do that. Dr. Brown, who I know that has been involved in their care, is working very diligently to try to find a cure for it.
Oh, absolutely. Let me just say something real quick.
This is Stephen.
I have had, as I said before, nothing but fantastic experience and respect. I mean, the men that I see and the women that I see, the doctors, are like Jamie described them, sort of firemen who are in there every day in the trenches working to find the cure. That's not what we're saying. We're looking at this and saying, well, if you think you're going to be dead in 5 years, is there anything out there that's going to have any effect on that right now? And we said, no.
And I think the other thing that's interesting is that if you, Dr. Finman, think about it this way. I'm watching what's happened to researchers that, quote, overstepped the bounds. And they're vilified. They're destroyed. And I'm imagining a fireman who, having made a decision to try and rescue some individual, has this whole community ready to end their careers, everything they've built for, if they make one mistake and someone slipped off a ladder or was injured in the process. And yet we expect the doctors to take the risk. So, I mean, it isn't a question of better. It's a question of there are two angles that need to occur here. One is that I think patients themselves deserve more opportunity to make decisions about this risk-reward equation. They should be allowed to understand the process and decide if they're interested in risking their own lives to save their own lives.
Let's narrow it to the question of gene therapy. Dr. Freeman, if these men came to you, and you run the gene therapy program at Massachusetts General, and said, we're determined to try it against the odds that it may do no good, against the maybe small chance that it could itself kill a patient, what would you tell them?
This is where the field is today, and it's a very difficult question, and I would tell them that the way we have traditionally approached this problem is to get good data in animals that the procedure they want to undergo, gene therapy, the delivery of the gene, is not in itself harmful and poses an enormous risk, and with that preliminary data in hand suggesting that it's safe to do it, that proceeding is worth the effort. And the most important part of this process, which we labor very hard to assure, is that the person who's making that decision has full knowledge, which I think James and Stephen have done an enormous amount of work to acquire that for themselves, and then they make an informed decision to take that risk. And the most important thing is that that decision be fully informed. Some of the problem that we've gotten into in the gene therapy field in the last few months is the appearance of not having fully informed the individuals involved in the risk that they were taking. And I think that's a very important issue, and it's very clear in listening to James and Stephen, they understand the risks that they would be taking. Well, but there also is an important, an important responsibility on the part of the physician who's doing this to not attempt a therapy for which there really is no evidence that it would work. And that's where you draw the line in judgment, and it's a very difficult line to draw.
But close that circle. I mean, is there any evidence that gene therapy would work in Stephen's case?
Well, the particular disorder, ALS, is not an area of my expertise, but there is evidence that the product that they're talking about, this protein product, can have a benefit on the cells that are dying. And so that piece of information exists. But the major limitation for gene therapy today, there are lots of diseases for which we know if we could put the defective gene back into the cell, we'd have an extraordinary chance of actually curing the problem. But the limitation right now is the delivery system, is the ability to deliver the gene to the right cell in the right time and have it regulated in the right way. And our technology for doing that is still not up to the task.
But I'm not sure you really answered the question, Dr. Freeman. If they said, we want to do gene therapy, and you say, well, get fully informed, but the doctor shouldn't, you know, encourage them to do something that's not going to work, is it a go or a no-go?
Chris, I think it's not a simple yes-no here, because the problem is, what is the underlying information that there's any hope that it will work? And again, I am not involved in ALS research, so I'm less capable than I think James and Stephen to tell you what information exists today as to the prospects of that help. But I know that in the delivery systems, we have enormous problems in getting genes where we want them. There's the immune response to those genes, and the cells are often killed when the gene is delivered. There are problems that have not been worked out. And so you have this problem of not wanting to curtail hope, but you have very little evidence that it's going to work.
I want to get your opinion on another thing that sort of haunts me here, Dr. Freeman, and that is simply, I mean, activist patients are great, and every patient has to be the CEO of his own case to some degree. But doesn't this new world, of which the Haywoods are a kind of embodiment, put an unbelievable burden on patients who've got a medical problem to begin with and now are supposed to raise money, become doctors, take charge, be celebrities, direct their doctors, choose among, you know, any number of very long-shot possibilities.
Well, I think the effort they've put in is extraordinary, and I certainly wouldn't suggest that everyone is expected to take on the kind of burden that they've shouldered. But I think one should also take some comfort in know that the process by which we decide to focus our energies is centered on those problems that afflict most of us, so that we are spending a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of research effort to deal with those diseases that afflict the great majority of Americans. But as James and Stephen have pointed out, the disease that Stephen has affects a relatively small number of people, 25,000 people, and that often means that those diseases don't get the kind of attention that those who have them would like to see. And I think the effort that they've made is an important one and a laudable one.
And I want to make maybe I could try and answer this a little bit for you, too. One of the things that I find frustrating about this is that you're now operating in a climate where if you did decide that you personally believed that the risk-reward was worthwhile for this therapy, you know, which I do at this point, and you decided to try and, you know, enroll the surgeons and get this to go forward, and something went wrong or something did not work out, even though Stephen or whatever patient was involved accepted that risk, I think that you now exist in a climate where literally you would lose your institute, you would lose your career, and you would lose everything that you'd worked for. And I think that that kind of punishment for when as a society we punish doctors and set up the expectation that they are not allowed to make any mistakes with human life means that it is extremely difficult to move forward. And
is that fair, Dr. Freeman?
Well, I think the assertion that in the current climate that undertaking a gene therapy effort now that is not well substantiated and that failed would be a very costly one, not only for the patient but for the physician involved, is absolutely true. I think that there is a climate of concern about the rush into gene therapy, that some have done it prematurely and that some patients have not been perhaps as well informed as they should have been in taking the risk, and that there was not enough data to suggest it would be effective. And for all of those reasons, there's been certainly a great deal of criticism for those who've moved into clinical trials on gene therapy. And I think the assertion there that if you were to do that currently in this climate, you would run a very grave risk for your career is true. But remember, we have set up there is a difference here about the risk and the reward. We still are pursuing clinical gene therapy in those with cancer, with clearly terminal diseases, precisely because we know that the risk-benefit ratio there is highest. Much of the concern over the case at Pennsylvania was that the patient who died in that trial seemed to be in relatively good health. And much of the concern that was raised was that perhaps that patient should not have been treated because his life was not so clearly endangered.
Stand by, Dr. Freeman, if you would. The phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK, the ALS connection and the Gorilla Research connection. Nancy is calling from Wilton, New Hampshire.
Hi.
Hello, Nancy.
My husband was diagnosed with ALS in 1997, and he had bulbar form, which many people will know is very quick, and he died last year. We went to Mass General. They're wonderful. I think these brothers are wonderful. But I really would like to speak to those people who are living with this disease and caring for people, which is enjoy your life. We decided to do acupuncture. I mean, I think you need a plan. And we went to Amherst, Massachusetts, so we drove through Western Massachusetts every week, and we watched the seasons, and we noted our lives. And we didn't change tremendously, and it was okay, and I have no regrets. I was glad we could reject the technology. I didn't believe in it. I don't know if that makes sense. When we were faced with fatal, we chose low-key. Low-tech.
Nancy, it's an important testimony.
I know exactly Steven. How you feel. I mean, we joke in our house that it's all ALS, all time channel. And I've struggled with that decision, decide to go this direction or to go another. And I think that's also a personal decision that everyone can make.
And it's very important to have choices. And I think what you're doing is wonderful.
Thank you.
And I just also want people out there not to feel guilty if they don't think they can
absolutely.
Cure ALS.
Mm. Absolutely. I think that, I mean, that seems to be an undercurrent here, but it's really not. I mean, everyone makes these decisions when you're faced by this disease, and no matter what, I know that everyone I met with ALS is some of the bravest people I know. So,
see, when Stephen and I sat down about 3 weeks ago, and we were talking about what we would need to do if we try and implement a number of the ideas that we're thinking of. And the reality was, I said, Steve, if you really want to try this stuff, and we don't know it's going to work, and we don't know if it's going to make a difference, you need to literally plan to spend a day a week for the rest of the next 2-3 years in the hospital, in a doctor's office, dealing with this, because that's the reality that you're facing to try and take a gamble of making a difference. And it was not a conversation where we said, you know, we're assuming we're going to do this. It was a conversation of, if you even want to try to think about pulling this off, this is what you're going to have to do for commitment. And I can't answer the question for Steve whether that's worthwhile, but I do want to give that opportunity to him and to anyone else that wants to to make that try.
Hmm. Nancy, thank you for calling 1-800-423-8255. Matt is on the line.
Hey, Christopher, good morning.
Welcome, Matt.
Stephen, Jason, very excited about the research you're doing. My question was basically, has there been any interest shown in the pharmaceutical industry and the genes you're proposing?
At present, the gene therapy, I think, as Dr. Freeman said, there probably isn't enough evidence that we could get someone involved from an investment standpoint at this time. And there's also some complications to the intellectual property surrounding it, which make it less of an attractive investment. Mm-hmm. But that's a good point to talk about, because one of the things that we've discovered here is that our role in this scenario, in what we're doing, is not actually to act as a basic researcher. And in fact, we have the best basic research in the world in the United States. It's amazing. And what everyone is doing is phenomenal. It's like picking from this fertile field of ideas. But what we're doing is this first stage development cycle where we say, okay, what's the idea? How do we get it to the clinical trial process? And I think we're sort of committing as an institution to taking our ideas through phase one clinical trials where they're shown to be effective, at which point in time I would want to hand that off to a biotech. You know, a good partner would probably be Avigen, who does a lot of AAV work, and you know, license the idea to them in exchange for a rapid development cycle. And in fact, you know, the patent that we hold in the therapy would be something we would trade for a company that was agreeing to do this very aggressively and fast.
Hmm. Is there somebody out there? Have you got a potential partner?
There's a number of companies that this would be applicable to eventually. But I think that
sooner companies, you think, than hospitals or universities?
Oh, everything that we do would be in partnership with, I mean, this amazing group of doctors that Stephen referred to appropriately as heroes that are trying to move forward. But I think eventually, when you get to phase two and three trials, when the costs roll into the tens and $20 million, mm-hmm. that's not something we can do as a nonprofit. But we can probably get these research to the point where, look, we've shown it's safe in human beings, we've shown it has some effect, and then at that point in time, it's worth the investment, so it's worth the return on the investment. Mm-hmm. And I think that for orphan diseases, this is a critical missing step that isn't played, essentially, by almost any institution, which is that who does that first high-risk investment to take a therapy to the point where it goes from being an idea to being worth the return on investment for a venture capitalist or a company to get involved with.
Dr. Freeman, do you have to make these judgments yourself about sort of what's the atmosphere, the corporate or institutional atmosphere that's going to get us an answer?
Well, sure, we make those judgments pretty frequently, but where we're currently in the field is in the development of the tools for doing the gene delivery. And there are pharmaceutical companies supporting that kind of work. Much of it is supported at the basic science level by the NIH. The movement into the clinical trial, what James and Stephen are referring to as a phase one clinical trial, is where you've got something that you think has a potential to be valuable as a therapy, and you want to test it in now human beings to make sure it's safe. And that's what many of these gene therapy trials are right now, are determining whether the procedure and the delivery system is safe to put into a human being. And if you have evidence that it's safe, it becomes relatively straightforward to then get more funding, either from the pharmaceutical industry or from the NIH, to then pursue larger scale trials. So I agree completely with James and Stephen that their function here as a catalyst to getting to that first step is very valuable.
1-800-423-8255 makes the sort of medical pioneering connection with James and Stephen Haywood. Peter is on the line.
Chris, good morning.
Good morning to you, Peter.
I'm going to take a little different tack here, and I want to bring in another variable here that I think has been much overlooked by our medical profession as well as our culture. There was actually an article about this in the Boston Globe a couple of days ago on a group of people in Plainfield, Vermont, where there was a very high concentration of ALS, much, much higher than the national average, maybe 10 or 20 times as high as the national average. And the researcher, who's just graduated from medical school, says that it's his hypothesis that this is a result of an intensification of environmental toxicity. That is, there's been a lot of environmental toxins pushed into the atmosphere, where this researcher believes that this is what has contributed to a much higher intensity of the appearance of ALS and other major nervous system degenerative disorders.
Peter, I'd read about that town. What do we know about it, James?
Well, I'm interested. I tend to look at findings in a very brutally, I'll call it, what does it matter to me scenario, which is, you know, I take the research and say, how is this going to help me develop a therapy in the next 24 months? And if the answer is that I can't see a way that it helps me answer that question in the next 24 months, I sort of tend to not pay attention to it. But the question of what causes ALS is critical, and I think that it'd be very important that someone do a very effective epidemiology study of all the environmental factors involved in people. Incidences like this town where, you know, there was a suggestion of sort of lead and some other toxins that could be involved. Mm-hmm. Are definitely worth following up. Unfortunately, with ALS, it's very difficult to correlate those factors, because whatever toxic insult probably hit the body is probably gone by the time the patient has the disease. And whatever caused the original ongoing progression of the disease may have disappeared already. So trying to find that is going to be very difficult. But those kinds of large-scale epidemiology studies are critical.
I don't think there's any doubt that there are environmental factors in ALS. The question, as Jamie said, is, well, that's maybe the case, but what do you do next? And, you know, certainly with that's not an area we're trying to focus on right now.
I have a question for you and another for Dr. Freeman. Stephen, I want to know just how you're doing. I read in The New Yorker or someplace you said, you know, at every different stage of the disease, you say, at this level, I can handle it. And then it gets worse. How is it today?
Today's okay. It's been a rough couple of months. My legs have gotten a lot worse for walking, and I took a pretty nasty spill about 2 or 3 weeks ago and landed on my face, which is not the way to do it. But it's true. You go along. I find I have periods where I'm in adjustment, and I think I've just come through one of those with my legs, because I just can't get around by myself anymore as well or safely. So that's something to adjust to.
Hmm. I was very glad to see you get in on your own steam to the connection studio. Dr. Freeman, I guess my last question is for you, and it's, are we asking too much of these brothers?
Well, I think they've made an extraordinary effort, and I think you've heard from the phone calls from those who have family members with ALS how appreciative those in the community are for the effort. So I'm not sure we're asking it of them, but I think you've heard from everyone how much we're appreciative of the effort they've made. I think that some of the calls you've taken, though, have highlighted the problem the physician has, which is, at what point do you say to a patient, there isn't much we can do, and then the patient has to make the choice about making the effort these brothers have made or going off and enjoying their remaining days, as the caller from New Hampshire said, and that is an individual choice that each patient and their family makes.
What's important is that is a choice that the patient can make.
And I think that,
James,
what I want to do is I want to work for those patients, and I want to give them those opportunities, and I hope that something comes out of this, but the important question is that they get a chance to try.
James Haywood, thank you. Stephen Haywood, thank you, and the best. Thank you Dr. Mason Freeman. We had help today from Matt Lieber, John Hoder, Glenn Alexander, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Museum of Science featuring Secrets of Aging, a hands-on exhibition that explores the science behind aging. And by Swiss Air offering a new second direct